Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog right here on Dave Martell YouTube channel. We're going to be switching it up. We're going to be heading to Odyssey up here the next few weeks. Odyssey and Telegram and places like that. So YouTube stinks. There's no money here. They shadow ban us. So you know what? We don't need them, right? We're going to head over to some platforms that will help The Bog expand and help us keep going and keeping the Bog empire growing. But before we get started tonight, we are going to talk about the art of storytelling. But before we get started, like always, if you like The Bog, you support The Bog, make sure you go to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50, and you can get a mug, you get a sticker, you could get the RSS feed for the audio of every single show that we do to listen to on your car, in your car, on your commutes, at the gym, or at work. Patreon.com/thebog. Help us keep the lights on. If you want to support The Bog another way, make sure you go to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and check out some sweet merch. Man, White Boy Summer's almost over. You got to get some sweet Bog merch for the rest of the summer. What we got? 20 days left? Get you a muscle shirt, get you a cutoff. Get a hat. We got backpacks. We got dresses for the ladies and onesies for the babies. All kinds of stuff over there at shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. If you want to support a friend of ours, make sure to facebook.com/ironagejodish. Check out some ancient, authentic, Vedic astrology. This stuff is so cool. I'm telling you, our boy Neil John over there, brilliant. Guy's a genius. Absolutely. So if you decide to get a reading over there, make sure to tell him Big Dave sent you. But if not, go check him out. Facebook.com/IronAgeJotish. IronAgeJotish. The Bizarre Archives. Bro, let me tell you, so much love and appreciation. I am so endlessly grateful for each and every one of you Bog Lords and Bog Maidens that supported the project of the Bizarre Archives. It means so much to me and to so many of the authors that have been clawing and scratching their way into the industry. And now we are in print. And we've been in print for a little over a month. And we've blown all our milestones out, all of our all of the sales that we thought we were going to get, we tripled them. It's been wonderful. But if you haven't gotten your copy, make sure to go to thebizarrearchives.com and follow the links there. Or if you want to submit, there's criteria over there. But speaking of Bizarre Archives, one of the things that folks have been reaching out to me about Bizarre Archives is how much they love this idea of a new kind of movement into storytelling and how it has inspired them, and they want to get involved. And a lot of folks that picked up copies of the Bizarre Archives told me, I had a guy who's like a hometown buddy, you know, he like goes bass fishing and like plays fantasy football and stuff, and he hit me up. He's like, man, I bought a copy just to support you, and I loved it. I haven't read a story since high school. He hasn't read a book since high school, and he got a copy of the Bizarre Archives, and he loved it. And this has just been so wonderful, seeing how storytelling is so important and resonates with people, even though they haven't delved into it or gotten involved with it, or maybe didn't know that it interested them. And me and Andre, and you know, Tristan, he's not here with us this evening, but we've been talking about this, and this is something that resonates with us as a people historically. You know, it's a spiritual, cultural thing, storytelling, whether we're talking about the stuff of old or the stuff of you know, from the Iliad to Cthulhu to whatever. You know, storytelling is something that's ingrained in our culture as a folk, as a people. It has always been there, and it always will be there, from tales of great heroes to tragedies and comedies and so on and so forth. Storytelling has just always been so important to us, and something that is just like second nature to us. So, before we get started, Mr. Andre, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty good, Dave.
Excellent. So, Mr. Andre, when we talk about the art of storytelling, or maybe the spirit of storytelling, what comes to your mind?
The spirit of storytelling, I feel, are telling stories that are oftentimes bigger than, you know, your the mundanity of life. It's not about that time you went fishing in the creek. It's about the stories of powerful heroes. It's the stories of how things came to be, how that mountain got its shape. You're talking about gods, giants, demons. It's a way of adding, I guess, a variety, a kind of spice to a generally kind of boring existence, if we're being perfectly honest, in many ways. Storytelling is extremely basic for people. It's something that you see almost come up in an instinctual manner. Yeah. Children, for instance, love stories, and they have no reason to actually love them, but they do anyways. You don't have to teach them to like it. They do, by nature of just being born.
Yeah, it's something that's it'll carry like a moral teaching, or it'll be something to or something to beware of, or sometimes it's just spooky stories, right? There's something my grandparents' generation and before them, they were just so enamored with telling kids spooky stories and scaring the crap out of them. You know, that's just something that that generation of old people lived for. I remember, first of all, my grandfather, on my mom's side, he was just out of control with this kind of stuff. He would gather all the kids around. Didn't matter what holiday it was, he would gather the kids around. He would just tell these stories about ghosts and monsters and like demons or people, but like stuff that was like legitimately spooky. And I remember like kids would get really, really freaked out by this, but this got the imagination going crazy. Like I remember he told me this story about, I can't even remember what it was. He told the story about his grandmother in the old country, and there was some sort of ghost that would come and drag her out of bed, or like I can't even remember the story exactly. It had something to do with a ghost or a evil spirit and coming into her room and stuff like that. And I remember being a kid, and this scared me for like weeks. And I would like wake up and look, and I think that I saw something, and it wasn't really there. So that was the power that this had over my little mind. And I remember also as a little kid, I had a neighbor. His name was Nick, and Nick was a very prim and proper, old school. He was a World War II vet. He was just made of piss and gristle kind of guy, right? He chain smoked. He drank whiskey all day long. His lawn was always right. He had a big, beautiful garden. He had an old school Lincoln that he treated it like it was like a Bugatti or something like that. And he used to just wax his car. His car was immaculate. He was just like a tough guy. If he heard any sort of noise, he came out armed to the teeth. He was just like an old school Americana tough guy. And I used to go to his house, and this guy just had so many crazy stories. He used to tell me stories about how there was a goblin that lived in our woods. He said he had teeth as sharp as nails and eyes that were like big yellow baseballs, and his feet looked like they were as pointy as arrows. And like he used to tell me this story about this goblin, and like he would even go to the lengths of sometimes he would see me out playing or whatever, and he would come out with his gun or whatever looking around. I would run, Nick, what's going on? I was like, Mr. Nick, what's wrong? He's like, I saw that goblin. And he would just like really sell it. So it's like, I was so scared of this freaking goblin for so long. But this was like the power of storytelling to me as a kid. And I loved it.
I've had very much similar experiences myself where we went to all the people's houses on the island where I lived. And these people were often elderly, and they often had stories that they wanted to tell to kids. And they could range from just pretty standard stories, kind of fairy tale-ish, to just outright horror stories. And as kids, you just love being scared. It's horrible, but you really like it as well. It's not going to make you sleep well at night, that's for sure, but damn if it's not addicting. And you'd also have like these stories that were more like, I guess it was in hindsight a warning that you shouldn't go around messing around too much by the sea, because of course that's dangerous. But when you start including things like sea witches and sea trolls and corpses washing up on shore, grabbing your legs and stuff like that, it's pretty horrific for kids to hear. But it, as you say, got the imagination running. And one of the really cool things that I like about storytelling in general is that you can tell a group of people one story. Say you have five people, you tell them the same story, and they're going to have five separate interpretations of how that story appears in their head. The story is never the same for everybody else. Not the way you imagine it. Not the way that your imagination starts spinning and working out from that as well. It serves as a great source of inspiration, honestly, as a result.
Yeah, and you know, I notice that as a writer as well. You know, I have stories out there that, you know, like I got the stories in Bizarre Archives. One of the stories is a sci-fi story. And when the way that I tell the story, I imagine the setting a certain way, and then I hear feedback from people that, like, oh, man, I like that story, and blah, blah, blah. And then they're like, I like the dark feel, or I like the red planet feel of it. And they have, like, these very different interpretations of what the world looks like. And I'm like, it like blows my mind, because it's like it's all different than what I envision. But going back to what we were talking about with the old people telling stories, this was something that was super important for our people, going all the way back to ancient times, telling stories around a campfire. Because before writing, which a lot of people don't realize, the overwhelming majority of human history happened before the invention of writing. Like it's not even close. So we spent almost all of our existence telling oral stories. We told stories of the gods. We told stories of our ancestors. We told stories of the spirits and the land and the creation of the world and everything, right? It would be like, oh, my great-great-great-grandfather fought this serpent and blah, 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 blah. And a lot of times it was an allegory, or maybe it was real, or who knows. But this tradition, this oral tradition of telling stories, is just something that's ingrained in all of us. It's just ingrained in all of us. Do you guys out there that still hang out with your buddies and stuff on the weekends or whatever, what's the first thing you guys do? You trade stories about what happened during the week. You know, even if it's just like a silly, funny work story. You tell the story, and we're going to get into this later on, about how there is a formula to stories. We have an ingrained formula to stories that people react to. And those of you that have read Joseph Campbell and like The Hero's Journey, or are familiar with Freytag's Pyramid, which is what we're going to talk about later, these are formulas that are like already in our mind. We already understand how a hero is supposed to develop, or how a story is supposed to go. These are things that are just inside of us, right? So, but when we talk about oral tradition, and then oral tradition going into eventually becoming texts, we as heathens, this is very, very important to us. Because, and this is something that I've noticed in the heathen community, is the heathen community is loaded, absolutely loaded, with people that are wonderful storytellers. Whether they're just hilarious, crazy stories, or like telling about going hunting, or things that they've done. It's just, there's people that are just very gifted with oration, and also tons and tons of writers. So many writers. I'll tell you, it was when I started getting Bizarre Archives together, I look back and it's just like, I'm like, oh, it's like everybody, that, not everybody, but the majority of writers in Bizarre Archives are heathens. It's just something that comes with the territory of who we are as a folk and as a faith. So when we talk about oral traditions, all of our ancient texts, our sacred texts, were originally oral tradition that and they weren't just like memorized camp stories. These were stories that the highest castes of priests had to memorize. They memorized it, and then the next person down had to memorize it, and then they memorized it, and so on and so forth, until eventually it got written down. It got transcribed, probably from older documents that existed that was transcribed before that. So we have no idea how old these stories are, and you know, it's just a really special thing to us.
Yeah, that's an important thing to remember, is that a lot of these old stories that were like these really old and stories from antiquity, the classical age and all that, when we're talking about the Iliad and the Odyssey, we're talking about the sagas and we're talking about the Eddas, and all of these things were really considered sacred, but they were not original works in the sense that someone sat down and wrote it out. These were stories that were collected and transcribed from a much older tradition. So we can know at least halfway when it was written down, but we got very little idea how old these stories might have been. And for each retelling, and that's just, this is an interesting facet of oral storytelling, for each iteration, it changes maybe a little bit. Some stories change just a little bit, and then the next retelling, it changes a little bit again. And ultimately, you start seeing this almost like this evolution. It becomes it's a work of its own. It becomes alive.
It's living.
It starts
it's a
breathing.
Tradition. Yeah.
Yes, it's a living tradition, and it requires living people to operate. It's not just a dead piece of paper that you can look at, and that doesn't change every time you look at it. And also, another important distinction of the oral tradition that a lot of people, I think, would take for granted when it comes to these stories is if you're sitting around your campfire with your buddies, you're having a few beers, you're sitting there sharing stories, and one of them, who is a really gifted storyteller, sitting there telling about the story of that time he almost got mauled by a bear, and it's you're just having a grand old time, and someone else tries to tell another story, and it just doesn't hit quite well, because it's the intonation of how you tell the story, the energy you put into how to tell the story, the show of the storytelling itself, not just the story, also helps bring this out. It brings it alive.
Yeah. Exactly. There's certain people that are just gifted with this. And we as a community have a lot of people that are gifted with this. Whether, like I mentioned earlier, whether it's something funny or it's something that's more meaningful or spiritual or whatever. There's just so many people around in our circles that are wonderful orators and wonderful writers as well. And when we start talking, and we're going to start getting into talking about more modern storytelling, because here's kind of the theme that we're probably going to touch on this a few times. And Tristan has mentioned this in the past. You know, if we believe in reincarnation, which we do, we would have to accept the fact that we are our ancestors, and which is objectively true. And if we are our ancestors, maybe we don't suck as bad as we think that we do. And maybe the stuff that we create is a little bit cooler than what we thought it was. You know, there's this kind of, especially around here with us, like, let's be honest, we're not as badass as our ancestors were. But what we create and what the stories that we tell, we are using the same talents and the same formulas, and it is coming from the same source, the same place that our ancestors drew from when they told their stories. So when we read maybe more contemporary stories, like maybe a fantasy story or something like that, you're not reading just some like modern piece of crap. Well, maybe you are in some cases, but in some cases, these like really like Lord of the Rings, for example, or the Wheel of Time series, or, you know, some of the like, dude, there's so many wonderful like stories like that. That's Tolkien was pulling from a special place when he wrote that story. Robert Jordan, when he was writing The Wheel of Time, is pulling from this really special place. Lovecraft, Robert E. Howard, Clark Ashton Smith, all of these guys that we really hold up as these wonderful, beautiful storytellers, they are pulling from the place that our ancestors were pulling from when they're telling their stories. And storytelling sort of took a little bit of a different turn when it came to technology. Like, what is one of our criticisms of the internet nowadays? When we talk about the internet, we usually say that it's a double-edged sword, right? For the first time in existence, we have access to more information than we ever could have possibly dreamed of in the past, right? But it also brings out the worst in people. So this was what happened when things like woodblock printing were invented. And the plus side of it was that it was more easily accessible to get things like the Tales of King Arthur, right? The Tales of King Arthur, you had, Beowulf was in there, so many other stories were available to more common people. It wasn't just written by hand by monks anymore. They would take these and woodblock printing, for people that aren't familiar, they had wood blocks, little tiny wood blocks that they would assemble to, and they would put ink on it and they would press it onto a piece of vellum or a page or what have you. And that's how they first made books. And this was way faster than scribes, right? Because before that, books were so expensive. That's why in like really old texts, you hear stories about some guy that had a library. If you had a library in like the late medieval times, that meant that you were rich as hell. That meant that you were a learned, very wealthy, well-to-do person. You were probably a lord if you had a library. So after that, when woodblock printing came into effect, then, you know, some landowners could have some books that they passed down to their kids and so on and so forth. And then come 1440, we're talking, you know, 15th century, mid-15th century, the printing press was invented. And the printing press not only made it available to lords and wealthy landowners, but then more common people could get their hands on books. Now, the problem with this, it was a double-edged sword, because as Plato had a criticism of teaching people how to read. He said, if you start teaching everybody how to read, they're going to start forgetting how to memorize things, which is what we say about smartphones now, right? You have a calculator and a map and everything on your smartphone now. You forget how to navigate. You forget how to do math in your head. It's a double-edged sword. But storytelling then became more available, and more importantly, it became profitable. So then you had guys that started to write stories because it had monetary incentive to it. And then it went so on and so forth. Then, like, you know, the technology of printing really, really took off, and it came all the way to how it is now. And it's like, I can, without any money, sign up on Kindle Direct Publishing, upload a manuscript and a book cover, and I now have a book. I'm now a published author. So it's like, it has come a long way. But with that, the ability to tell stories to more and more and more people, and to bring storytelling back to its place of importance and of availability and accessibility for people has kind of come full circle, in my opinion.
I think you're right there in saying that it's a double-edged sword, because, of course, like when you saw the rise of the printing press and the woodblock printing and so forth, it became more accessible to write books, and the more people could read books. And as a result, more people got inspired and wanted to tell their own story. So you started getting more people interested in it, and this really picked off with the printing press. A lot of people seem to think that the printing press was exclusively used to just make and print Bibles. This was not the case at all. Most of what was printed was basically pseudo newspapers, propaganda posters, and a lot of fiction books, because people really love fiction. They love telling fiction, and the more people read fiction, the more they wanted to read more of it, and maybe they wanted to create it. And this is what we see, especially now, as you say, like this idea of just uploading something, just write, type something down, upload it to Amazon with a book cover, boom, you're a published author. And as a result, you have, I guess I could just say that straight out, you have a massive oversaturation of stories, and that's both good and bad in a way, because there's a lot of good stories. Like, we don't know, I don't know if this is even heresy to even imply that, but we don't know if the next J.R. Tolkien has been born or not. Most people who are authors will not be Tolkien, but maybe one will, and we don't know, because he might have lost his story down the Amazon hellhole somewhere.
Yeah, so as Andre said, it's a double-edged sword. It's not just that, dude, there's multiple other companies that do similar things to Amazon. But here's the thing with this, like, self-publishing technology that we have now is, yeah, there is a huge saturation of just garbage. There's so much lousy stuff up out there. Any idiot that has a keyboard and a computer or a laptop or even a smartphone, anybody that has access to Google Docs can now become a published author. And there's tons and tons and tons of that. And most of them go nowhere or whatever. However, because of the nature of the publishing industry and because there are so many just like greasy, awful gatekeepers, this is also a boon for us in that people that would just be completely ignored or blackballed in today's climate have a chance to get their stories heard and read because they put it out there, right? So it's a double-edged sword. But when we get into the idea of storytelling and how prominent it was in ancient times, and now it's coming back around to its how prominent it is now. And the kind of the reason I wanted to talk about this, like I mentioned with my project, the Bizarchives, tons of people have submitted stories that told me that this is my first ever story. I don't know if it's good. I just wanted to do it. And I read them. And if you put a story in, I will read it. And I've had people, you know, send me their story. Let me know what you think. Unfortunately, I don't have time to get back to everybody. But I will read your story because I don't know. Because probably about 20% of the people that say, I don't know if this is any good, it's usually pretty good. It may not be good enough to publish, but they have this natural ability to tell a good story. And then the rest of the 80%, they usually have the ability, if they practiced and they maybe watched some writing courses or like something like that, they could become good writers. There's more good writers out there than what people realize. So, you know, it's just like an incredible thing to think about.
A lot of people would get scared because it's just a general mentality that I see a lot, that there is a desire to tell stories. There is a lot of desire to want to write stories and maybe publish or something like that, but they don't do it because they're scared of the reception of it. They're scared that whatever they write will just not be as good as, well, again, like Lord of the Rings, everybody expects that their first work is going to be Lord of the Rings, and it can't be worse than that. And what I want to say to people is that it's not necessarily a bad thing that there's an oversaturation on the market when it comes to books and stories. The problem is the incentive that people have for writing said stories. As Dave said, with the Bizarchives, you have a lot of amateur writers. You have people who have never written anything before. Maybe they've tried to make something before and they don't have practice, they don't have the training, they don't have the skill set. But that's not entirely, it's not entirely relevant either, because if you read a story that someone wrote and really put their heart and soul into, there might be spelling errors, there might be a bit of pacing issues, all these technical difficulties, of course, but you will sense the effort. You can't just half-ass a story. You can't just half-ass whatever you can in like a month and then publish it, and then a month later you publish something else just because you're trying to make some cash off it. If you really apply yourself and you really attempt to write something, that will show through, I believe, because a good story is a good story regardless.
Yeah, exactly. And what Andre's saying with a good story is a good story regardless is, it goes back to in our souls, in our subconscious, we have this ability to formulate. Not everybody, some people got to work on it, but we all fundamentally have this same kind of understanding of how a story should go, right? And when you read this and you see this, and I read a lot of stories that are just a lot of submissions that are, I don't want to say poorly written, but are that have mechanical issues, right? There's just like tons of you know, run-on sentences. It's not you know, formatted correctly. It has errors in it. However, they understand the flow and the format of a plot for a story because they just have that instinct. And there are quite a few formulas that have been put down to articulate this. One of them, the most famous one, is probably called, it's called Freytag's Pyramid, or it's called the Story Pyramid, or like whatever the, you know, I'm sure you've learned, everybody learned it about it in high school. You know, it starts out with a beginning, you have your rise, you have your climax, you have your descent, and then you have your resolution. People understand this instinctively. And there's other formulas that go with it. You know, there's one that's called like the three acts plot formula or something like that. It's pretty much the same thing as that, but it's put in a linear fashion. And I believe that a pulp short has a little bit of a different anatomy than perhaps other stories are. But this guy Freitag that came up with the pyramid, his name was Gustav Freitag, and he was around in the 1800s. He's a German guy, and he studied ancient storytelling, everything from Shakespeare to the Odyssey, so on and so forth. He read it all, and he started to see a common trend in how the stories were formulized, and that's what he came up with. And it's tried and true, and people have been using it for hundreds of years now. So that's something that's just in with in your mind as a person that has an understanding of storytelling. Now, when we talk about storytelling, and speaking of guys, everything from Shakespeare to the Odyssey and so on and so forth, we have this, and I mentioned this before, we have this belief that what people have written over the last 50, 60, 70 years is trash and modern and fake and gay, and everything in antiquity was wonderful and awesome and great. We suck and they're cool, and that's it. And I just disagree with this. I disagree with this. Like I said before, are we as awesome, and are we warrior kings and ancient? Do we have the nature of ancient people and the toughness and the resilience? Probably not. But as I said before, this is a continuation of that tradition, and it's important for us to carry the torch, because if we break this tradition and we forget how to do it, when the cycle comes back around and we come back to a golden age, we won't have that skill anymore. And I would argue that without that skill, we can't go any farther. You know, there's so much that goes into, like, there's this chicken or the egg argument when it comes to storytelling. It's what came first, the tales or the hero? You know, what happened first? Was there a hero that inspired the tales, or did the tales inspire the hero to be a hero? And then there's this cycle of tales inspiring heroes, inspiring tales. Same thing with technology and science fiction. You know, a lot of scientists and inventors have credited science fiction stories for giving them the conceptualization of the technology. Would we have touchscreen phones if it wasn't for Gene Roddenberry in Star Trek Next Generation, like, or the original Star Trek? Would we have any of these things if they were not dreamed up of by storytellers? You know, guys that conceptualized it first. So the analytically minded people, the inventors, they took the conception and they turned it they manifested it into reality. So, in my opinion, without this influence from people with the talent of conceptualization and storytelling, can we really move forward and do great things and great feats?
I would agree with that, because it's not just about the inventions and the people who were willing to maybe think up new things and inspire other inventors to maybe go ahead with that. It's also just a matter of general inspiration, because how many people have not felt moved or inspired by a story that shows, you know, a great degree of heroism? How many people today, for instance, owe their career choices and general lifestyle choices if they grew up watching, say, Conan the Barbarian, because they wanted to be that. They wanted to be that type of cool, badass hero figure, and that would have inspired them later down the line.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at, you know, like we were talking about Pulp Fiction that happened, you know, I mean, everybody's heard me talk about Pulp Fiction ad nauseum with all the shows I've been on and everything, which I appreciate and love all those guys, by the way. Everybody's heard me talk about Pulp Fiction, the history of Pulp Fiction, and so on and so forth. But if you go look at these heroes that appear in these Pulp Fiction works from the 20s, 30s, and 40s, these heroes have the same anatomy as the heroes of antiquity. It's like you know, Conan and Call the Conqueror and Elric that was written by Michael Moorcock. And then you have, you know, Doc Savage and Buck Rogers and like all of these guys. The anatomy of who they are is like no different than the heroes of antiquity. It's just like we have taken this blueprint of the hero and put it into a setting that we understand and we can conceptualize and we and then that we can dream up and we can empathize and relate with, right? We can relate with the guy that you know shoots the bad guys with pistols and rifles and stuff. We can relate with the guy that lives in a metropolis. We can relate with the guy that you know, whatever, right? We can relate with these guys. They speak our language. They wear clothes like we wear. But at their core, primordially, they hold the blueprint of the heroes of the ancient world. So it's just a continued tradition of doing so. However, and we were talking about this earlier in our little bog chat with me and the panel, we were talking about the nature of the hero and how it kind of changed for the worse in modernity.
Yeah, so what he's referring to here is that when you look at something, you look at a hero figure, your thoughts automatically start straying and thinking without really analyzing it. You don't go into full literary analysis and say, oh, yes, that's a hero because ba-ba-ba-ba-bum. You look at it and think, okay, yeah, that's the hero. You know instinctually. And like that's where it becomes a little bit like interesting to look at the essence of what makes a hero. What is a hero compared to another guy? And obviously, one of the more important things that you can tell by heroes is just a general, I guess we would just call it Chad today. It's like this energy, just a massive manly alpha Chad energy. He takes no shit and he gives no shits.
Yeah, as Nietzsche would say, the Übermensch. It is a telling of an Übermensch, right? So this is something that was kind of lost in a little bit of modernity. When you, like I mentioned about the pulp heroes, you have guys like Buck Rogers and Doc Savage and Conan and Call the Conqueror and so on and so forth, and the many Western guys and, you know, the ass kickers and barbarians and warlords and futuristic space fighters and all these guys that were alpha Chad, kick evil's ass, get the girl, you know, whatever. They were these, you know, gritty, hard-knuckled, tough guys, right? But they were also smarter than they looked, and they did what was right, and like all this kind of stuff. But they were dynamic characters. They were relatable. They were really cool characters. When you start getting into the late 50s and then into the 60s, the nature of the hero really changed in modern fiction. And then you start getting guys like Superman and Aquaman and first incarnations of Batman and so on and so forth. And these characters, let's face it, they were gay and they were boring. They were Mary Sues, right? And for those of you that are Andre, tell us what a Mary Sue is.
Oh, okay, so basically what's called a Mary Sue, or occasionally also called a Gary Stu, is it's a figure, of a literary figure. Think Superman. He has basically no flaws. He has no flaws. He's not really interesting. He's not really human. He's perfect in any way. He always wins. Nothing interesting really happens that actually threatens them, apart from maybe, say, kryptonite, but that's such a vague and ambiguous kind of weakness. Like, these people are always acting like absolute moral paragons. Superman would never do anything bad. Everybody just knows Superman would always do everything good, everything right, everything moral, all the time, without question. That's basically what a Mary Sue figure is. It's someone who has no flaws and always acts properly and perfectly all the time.
Yeah, exactly. It's a character that is not relatable. It's a character that's not human, right? You look at the pulp heroes going back all the way to the ancient heroes, and then some of we look at the heroes that are in Lord of the Rings. These heroes are flawed. They have fears, and they have things that make them angry. They make bad decisions. They have problems. Some of them have drinking problems, or sometimes they can be cruel or spiteful, or they are human, right? They have these very human, relatable traits about them that, and this disappears probably because of the influence of cultural Protestantism in America when that took hold, and they just like re-sanitized, homogenized these heroes into being these bland pieces of crap, right? And that sucked for a long time, and that influenced characters going forward. So now you look at we're in modernity, and like all we are in post-modernity, and the characters that that these people are writing now, not just in comic books but in fiction too, they create settings because they learned from the original Superman, the original Aquaman, and like all of these supposed heroes. They have now come to the logical conclusion of that. So the children of these Mary Sues are nihilist. They don't have any. There's no struggle to them. They're cynical. It's like when you look at. Let's go back to the pulp guys, the pulp heroes. They themselves were flawed, right? And we can throw the guys from Lord of the Rings in here too. These characters were flawed. However, they were forces that acted on behalf of goodness, right? There was an overarching goodness that they worked for. When you go into early Superman and these like corny, sanitized Mary Sue characters, the overarching goodness kind of disappears, and they are the goodness. I am the protector of everything. I blah 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 blah, like that. It's you can tell that it's very Protestant, culturally Protestant, because it's yes, it's very sanitized and it's very boring and it's very straight laced, but it's also very individualist. It's also very liberal, and in so far as it goes from there is this good that I kneel to and that I serve, and even though I am a fallible, flawed human being, I serve that good to the best of my ability, and my ability is great, so on and so forth. It went from that to me, I am the best, I am the good, I am this, blah, blah, blah. And then where does that lead to? Where did liberalism and modernity in that time period lead to? It leads to postmodernism. And when we get into postmodernism, we get into critical theory, we get into nothing matters, we get into deconstructing nature itself and trying to liberate ourselves from nature. So now we have heroes that aren't even heroes. They don't have the overarching goodness, nor do they have the inner goodness. They have nothing. And that has led to a complete crash in storytelling and fiction works.
A lot of what you're saying here is basically a reaction. People were reacting to... I believe it was Tristan who said that this entire concept of your typical superhero in the 50s and the 60s were basically caused by a moral panic where they had to be washed squeaky clean and could not act in any way, sense, or form immoral by the standards of the time. But simultaneously, as you said, they removed the concept of goodness. There was no concept or overarching theme of goodness anymore. They became a symbol for goodness. They became the goodness itself. They became prophets. And as a result, it got really goddamn preachy, if we're being honest. Superman is really annoying about his preachiness about how you're supposed to act. Because he's the paragon of all that is good. You can't possibly live up to that, so he can sit there and talk down to you. Because he could probably beat you up if he wanted to anyways. And that kind of gives a really mixed message. A lot of people then grew up with this and became disillusioned with it. And you ended up with a reaction where they started creating anti-heroes, and then they basically created what they thought was an anti-hero. But that's not even a hero. It's just borderline straight up a villain. It's an evil Mary Sue.
I wouldn't even say that they're creating villains. They just create nothing burgers, just like meaningless, cynical nihilists that don't even remember why they fight crime or why they fight evil. They just they just kind of go with the motions because that's like the script that they are traditionally supposed to follow, right? So they don't even, there's no epistemology behind it. It's just, that's just what they, oh yeah, well, these are heroes and this is what heroes do. But they're going to be not like the Mary Sues, and they're going to not care, and we're going to deconstruct what heroism is, what it is about. So, you know, what? Go ahead, Andre.
No, I was just going to bring up a point here, and correct me if I'm wrong, and this goes for pretty much anything, but like a good example of this is someone like Batman, because in the beginning he was also kind of like squeaky clean. He was supposed to be moral, and he acted like a moral person, and he was just kind of like a little bit boring and a little bit silly. If you look at like old cartoons from that period and compare it to the modern Batman, it's a stark contrast, because especially his reasoning for fighting crime, the way I have understood it is that in the beginning it was more of a sense of right, it was a sense of justice, that, you know, you had to beat up the bad guys and punish crime because that's the right thing to do. This later then transitioned into the more famous story of Batman having his parents killed, and the resulting trauma basically made him go on a vigilante revenge spree. Like, this, the motivation for why he's doing what he's doing changed, but what he did, what he's doing basically didn't change. And that motivation can tell a lot about the moral fabric of a hero and can make them far more relatable. It has to be done well, though, or else you just start delving into really weird and cringy territory. And I think Batman has been done really well.
Yeah, well, when it comes to... but going back to the anti-hero versus the Mary Sue... our boy Tristan put it very well. He says the anti-hero isn't even really a thing. It's just a hero, whereas the Mary Sue is a failure of storytelling. And I agree with this. The Mary Sue doesn't appear anywhere before cultural Protestantism in America, before modernity and liberalism and cultural Protestant really took hold and took command of the country and its publishing arms. The Mary Sue was like nothing. It was influenced by Janney micromanaging gatekeepers that outlawed fun, right? It was by the same people that are doing it now, but they're just on a, they just think that they're different, right? The people now that are like, you can't say that because that's racist, bigoted, neo-Nazi, you know, colonizer, whatever that crap that they say. It's the same. They're cut from the same cloth. This is just more cultural Protestantism rejecting the true nature of masculinity and the true nature of humanity and primordialism and things like this. It's just a rejection of these things. Whereas in the 50s and the 60s, you had these church ladies and these like uptight squares that were like, well, we have to remove any sort of flaws from the characters. We have to remove anything from the characters to make them human. They have to be sterilized, blah, 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 blah. And then they're, because they come from an ideology that is just all about thought policing, right? It's thought policing mixed with individualism. And it's just complete garbage, right? So instead of saying, oh, that's racist and bigoted and blah, 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 they said, well, this is, you know, so on and so forth, and they thought policed it, and they gate kept it, and they poisoned it, which is the same exact thing that's going on now. But there are a lot of folks that are pushing back against that, right? I would like to think that the Bizarre Archives pushes back against that and tries to get back to the unabashed form of portraying humanity and portraying heroism in the way that it should be portrayed, in that a man of great talent and of great strength and great ability is probably also going to have great flaws and greater struggles than what normal people do, right? A great hero isn't going to be like, oh, man, well, it's raining today. Oh, man, well, I got a flat tire. He's going to be like, oh, man, now I have to, you know, fight this interdimensional, horrible monster that's trying to destroy all of reality. Yeah, I mean, it's a completely different level of being. You know, it's the freaking Ubermensch, right? So that's, you know, that's what it is.
I mean, you have to understand, like, when it comes to storytelling and so forth, giving your hero flaws seems stupid, because why would a hero have flaws? But that's exactly what makes them fun, entertaining, and relatable. And they don't have necessarily have to be, like, massive flaws. Like, you don't have to make them a goddamn psychopath. But if you look at, like Greek myths are a good example of what are... They're called heroes. They are heroes. They act like heroes. But they're also sometimes incredibly violent. They have vices. They're petty. And this relates them to us. Like, if you compare to, for instance, the story of Achilles. What Achilles spends a lot of his own story just sulking in a tent. Because he's kind of pissy at the king. That's a relatable feeling for a lot of people. Like, he's been granted divine godly powers, and he's not using it because he decided that it was a good idea to be petty instead, and he needs a good incentive. And then he gets his incentive by the revenge that he has to take when his own cousin gets killed.
Yeah,
these are flaws that makes the character both relatable and interesting. If Achilles just didn't have this, he would not be an interesting figure at all. He'd be boring.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point. Project Destagnation says the badass archetype is meant to be unachievable. Cultures prior to modernity accepted authority, and in those cultures, heroes were the authority. Yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. I don't think, like you have all these people that put themselves into Harry Potter, that put themselves, and then they're like, that's me. No, that's not you. That's not you. But I would argue that on the devil's advocate, I would argue that a writer that creates a hero must put himself into the hero, must make a hero that he's able to get into their head, and so it's more real, right? So it's more believable and immersive.
You can't make a hero and write a realistic hero that seems like a real human in third person by using a recipe list you found online of what a true hero is supposed to be.
No.
It's not going to come alive then. It's not going to seem real. Everybody's going to be able to tell that, yeah, that's fake. That's not, no, not buying it.
Yeah, exactly. And I do it with the characters that I write. Even bad guys, even guys that are up to no good, I put my qualities into them because I want to be able to live through their thing. Like, I don't know how to explain it. You know, I'd say every character that I make that's of importance has a little piece of me in it, because that's how I try to bring these characters to life, right? And I meant, we were talking about this. I put this in my voice message before. The character that appears in Bizarrechives 1, he's going to be in like every Bizarrechives ever. His name is Lucius Lex, and he is a dark paladin in a grim, dark world. And he's this big, mean, ugly guy, and he has some like mysterious magic power. And he goes around fighting demons and cosmic horror entities and monsters and like anything that happens. He goes and he does it, but he's got a little bit of me in him, right? He's got a little bit of Dave. He's obviously not me, but he's got some of my qualities in him, because I wanted him to be real. And the best way that I could make somebody feel real is to put myself into them, right? So that's what it is. And, you know, that's what Destagnation said about having a hero be unachievable. That's the point. The heroes in these stories do things that you wish you could do, right? They break rules that you wish you could break. They achieve things that you wish you could achieve. They do these things, and that provides inspiration to you to try to overcome the struggles that you do. Although they are much, much smaller in scope and scale, it inspires you to do so. So it's like, is Conan the Barbarian and Lucius Lex and Solomon Kane, and are these guys, are they Achilles, and are they Beowulf, and are they, they're different. But they're based on those ancient guys. They are the great, 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 great grandchildren of those guys, reborn. And speaking of being reborn, we're talking about the Mary Sue that went that kind of took over storytelling in the 50s going into the 80s. Conan can pretty much be credited as the guy that slayed the Mary Sue. Because after that period, after the 80s, we started to see grittier heroes. Because what happened was Marvel Comics, despite the lamentations of Stan Lee, who hated fantasy and sword and sorcery, despite his lamentations, Conan, the Savage Sword of Conan, came out in Marvel Comics in 1974. And before that, Marvel Comics was in the tubes. They were going down. Like, nobody heard of them. They were about to go bankrupt. And then they did Savage Sword of Conan comic, which became their most popular comic. The Savage Sword of Conan the Barbarian in Marvel Comics was at one point more popular than Captain America and Spider-Man and everybody combined. He was the king of Marvel Comics for a while. And what did Stan Lee do when he got the money back is he dumped it and he like brought back his corny superheroes. However, what happened was this introduced an entire generation of people into sword and sorcery, into Robert E. Howard and Pulp Fiction. And not only that, they could never go back to a Mary Sue character like that ever again. From that generation, from the influence of Conan in comic books, came Spawn.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. That transition was an important facet of storytelling in general. And you see it in comics, you see it in books, and you see it in movies. And movies has to be included in this as well, as they also tell stories. And people like these types of stories where there is a little bit a side of a darker, grittier piece of a person's personality in general, because we all have these same types of thoughts ourselves. We have dark thoughts and desires at times that if we were in a heroic situation where we had the powers of a superhero, would we be able to contain that, or would we just let that come out?
I'm out there.
No, I was talking about that this shift in mentality between the squeaky clean superheroes and the darker, grittier Conan, who was far more relatable, resulted in I guess you could call it in a way of like a small renaissance that people relate stronger to, because everybody has those deep, dark desires themselves, and these dark personality traits makes them seem more realistic and more relatable, and it allows people to kind of, I guess, in a way, have a therapeutic and more realistic and enjoyable experience reading and hearing about these types of anti-heroes and darker tier.
They have hands and they have bellies. They lust and they hate. You scratch the skin of civilization and beneath you will find the ape roaring and red-handed. And that quote just resonates with me so hard. And I know you guys have heard me say that before, but that is such a good quote because it's so true. It's so true. He's talking about how his characters, they have more of the masculine qualities than these like bureaucratic, you know, pot-bellied goblins that go around and gatekeep and suck, right? His characters are more human than the supposed humans are. And he says they have hands and they have bellies. They lust and they hate. And that is something that man has. Man feels lust. Man feels hate. Man has these intense feelings and these desires. And he has these things. And while these desires can have negative outcomes, they are still there, and they are still important to who we are. They still are important to our identity as men, right? Even if they are negative. And to create a hero, a true hero, he must have these qualities. Even if he fights them, even if he struggles against them, he must have them, because that is like the pure, raw, primordial, masculine form. And he says, if you scratch the skin of civilization, beneath you will find the ape roaring and red-handed. And that's just like so, it's just such a powerful statement. But unfortunately, Mr. Andre, we are out of time tonight. So we got to wrap it up here. We were going to get into how movies ruined people's imaginations, and everybody should go back to reading fiction as opposed to watching it, because when you watch too much stuff and it's already visualized for you, you begin to lose the ability to visualize yourself, right? You begin to lose the ability to read text and create visualizations in your mind, which are very, very important to inspiration and imagination and spirituality too. It's very important to have that talent. So movies can be cool, but limit your movies, read fiction, and read Bizarrechives. Like, if you haven't had you don't got your copy of Bizarrechives yet, go over, grab it, read it, because issue 2 is like in the works, man. We're like getting done with it already. And we got more stuff coming out too. So, last show for Bizarrechives, Bizarrechives, thebizarrechives.com, thebizarrechives.com, The Bizarrechives, Weird Tales of Monsters, Magic, and Machines. Issue 1 is available. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in tonight. All the Bog Lords and Bog Maidens. If you like the Bog, you support the Bog, make sure you go to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody. $5 all the way up to $50. You can get a sticker, you can get a mug, and most importantly, you get the RSS feed so you can get the audio of every single show that we do to listen to in your car or on your commutes, at the gym, or at work. Check it out, patreon.com/thebog, to help us keep the lights on. If you want to support the Bog another way, make sure to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and check out some sweet merch. Dude, White Boy Summer's almost over, guys. We got like 3 weeks left. Do you have a Bog muscle shirt? Do you have a Bog cutoff? Do you have a Bog bucket hat? No, you don't. Go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and get yourself some sweet Bog merch. We got hats, we got backpacks, we got dresses for the ladies and onesies for the babies over there if you want to help support us another way. If you want to support a friend of ours, make sure to facebook.com/ironagejodish and give him a like and check out some authentic ancient Vedic astrology. This stuff is so cool. I'm telling you, this stuff is, it's going to blow your mind. I'm telling you. Everybody's got a reading, has told me how incredible it is. I've gotten a reading. Everybody on the Bog panel's gotten a reading. It's off the charts, guys. It's so cool. Our boy Neil John is just brilliant. You can go check out, we got shows with him. Just type in the Bog, Jodish, Neil John, or something like that. It'll come right up. Or you could just go look in the playlist over there. Facebook.com/IronAgeJodish. If you decide to get a reading, tell him that Big Dave sent you. Tell him Big Dave sent you. In the next few weeks, we are going to migrate over to Odyssey. YouTube blows, and I'm not sorry, and I'm done with it, and all that stuff. So go find the Bog over on Odyssey. I don't know. I can't remember if it's the Bog or Dave Martell or something like that. But go over there and follow. We're going to be over there. We're going to be running it from there, and we're going to be doing more on Telegram as well. So do those things. You want to follow me on Telegram, it's t.me/theboglord. And like always, I'm going to raise a horn to our most exalted patrons, our very own Andre and our good boy, Mr. Corey. Hail to them, also hail, and many blessings to them, and to each and every one of you Bog Lords and Bog Maidens that continue to support us. Man, we are so endlessly grateful for you guys and your support. So much love and many blessings to each and every one of you, and we'll see you guys next week. I don't know if we're going to do Monday or Friday. We'll be back very soon, 6 p.m. Eastern, right here, Dave Martell YouTube channel. Many blessings and many hails to each and every one of you. I'll see you guys soon, all right? Hail!